Well, it's just on 5:30, so I think we might start the debate. The Popper debate is an annual event at the LSE held under the auspices of the Centre for Philosophy of Natural and Social Science, and we choose a different topic, of course, each year. And this year, the topic is science and religion, conflict or peaceful coexistence. And we've got three speakers. So what we're going to do is to have three fairly brief presentations, about 15 minutes, 20 minutes or so. So let me introduce the initial speakers. On my extreme right, we have Peter Atkins, who's Professor of Chemistry at Oxford and a Fellow of Lincoln College, and the author of a book called The Creation, but that is written from the strictly scientific point of view, I think. And then we have Keith Ward, who was until recently was Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford, formerly Professor of History and Philosophy of Religion here in London at King's College, and also a Canon of Christchurch. And he's an author of a large number of books dealing with various aspects of religion and its relation to science. Particularly, think of some provocative titles like Defending the Soul, I think was one of Keith's books. His most recent one is called The Case for Religion, which has just come out. And then on my right here we have Peter Lipton, who is my successor as Professor of History and Philosophy of Science at Cambridge, now called the Hunt's Rousing Chair. He's a Fellow of King's College and author of many interesting, important articles in philosophy of science, in particular author of a monograph entitled Inference to the Best Explanation, which has become a sort of classic, just come out in a second edition. So those are our three speakers. And so what we're going to do is to, first of all, we're going to have Peter Atkins introduce his point of view, and then reply from Keith Ward, and then Peter Lipton will speak. If it seems appropriate, I may introduce one or two questions myself, and then we'll throw the whole thing open to the audience for their questions and participation. So first of all, Peter Atkins.
Well, thank you very much. It's not my intention to be at all controversial this evening. I shall, in fact, pretend to start with an open mind and examine these questions before drawing my foregone conclusions. I shall ask whether science is a better mode of understanding than religion, whether there are parts of reality that science cannot reach, and whether religion is a better source than science of good. I don't wish to circumscribe my colleagues' presentations, but it seems to me that these are three central questions for the current debate. So first of all, is science a better mode of understanding than religion? Now, the fundamental distinction between science and religion is that scientific explanations are built on shared, testable public knowledge, whereas religious explanations are built on individual, untestable, private knowledge. In short, faith is belief in the unbelievable. There are those who claim that religion is human enhancing and science dehumanizing. The opposite is true. Science respects the power of the human intellect and progressively develops the view that it is capable of complete understanding. In contrast, religion scorns the power of the human intellect, asserting that the intellect is simply too puny. Science represents the apotheosis of the Renaissance and respects the awesome power of human understanding far more nobly than religion does. Religion sees wonder in the world and is overawed. Science sees wonder and adds to that wonder by elucidation, deepening our delight by showing how this wonderful world can be rendered comprehensible. Religion, in short, obfuscates while science illuminates. Scientific understanding is in terms of a knowable underlying simplicity. Knowable, that is, on this side of the grave. Religious understanding is in terms of an unknowable complexity, or at most, a complexity that is knowable only on the other side of the grave. Science takes the view that our brains are capable of understanding while we are alive. Religion takes the view that brains are capable of greater understanding only when they are dead. Scientific explanation must lie in a matrix of interconnected ideas, with concepts drawn from one domain consistent with those drawn from another. Thus, biology must be consistent with chemistry, cosmology consistent with particle physics, and molecular biology consistent with astronomy. Religion need not be consistent with anything at all, even itself, as it is rooted in speculation and therefore free of any test. Scientific explanations are transnational, transcultural, and presumably universal. There is little doubt that, indeed, there is in fact evidence that the same scientific laws operate a billion miles away and a billion years ago. In contrast, religious explanations depend on where you were born. They might even vary within 100 yards. How can truth be so local? So I conclude that science is a better mode of understanding than religion. My second question was, are there parts of reality that science cannot reach? There are those who assert that science's sharp sword, when brought to bear on belief, cannot slice through the fabric of the heavens. They assert that there is a side of existence that is left in shadow by science's brilliant light, and that religion alone is able to illuminate things of the soul. I fear that that is just plain nonsense, and the circumcision of domains of knowledge a sure sign that religion is fearful that science will tread on the tender patches that it regards as peculiarly its own. Science can illuminate wherever it turns its gaze. It can illuminate the structure and workings of the physical world, and it is starting to understand the structure and workings of that extraordinary instrument, the brain, that we use to detect the outside world and to create the inner world for our own and others' amusement. It is capable of understanding the physiological and psychological roots of self-delusion, including religious belief, and can illuminate the roots of undisguised madness. Any explanation that takes the form, God did it, is a dishonest way of saying, we don't know. Science is honest, for in the face of ignorance, it admits that it doesn't know. Religion is dishonest, for in the face of ignorance, it lies. Science cannot yet say what happened at the inception of the universe, but look at the extraordinary progress that has been made with this awesome problem in the 300 years since serious science began, and compare that progress with the sterility of religion's puny dabblings with this extraordinarily important question in the 6,000 years that it has claimed authority. Religion has exhibited its impotence. Science continues to display its omnipotence. Religion invents empty questions and then claims that only it is on the track of the answers, thus it speculates that there is a purpose in the universe and claims that only it can see into the mind of God to discern that purpose, and then usually and feebly concludes that God's mind is in fact inscrutable. That science cannot identify the purpose of the universe is not a sign of science's impotence, for the question is empty. There is no purpose in the creation of the universe. Religion struggles with the question of evil. Science scorns the Odyssey and sees evil simply as behavior. Look at the simplicity and clarity of science's resolution of these questions. There is no purpose, and evil is consistent with a loving God because there is no God. And contrast that with religion's unintelligible contortions. So I conclude that as well as science being a better mode of understanding than religion, there are no parts of reality that science cannot reach. And thirdly, is religion a better source than science of good? Conflict in science is invariably resolved peacefully, for science can settle disputes by appeal to experiment. Whenever conflicting behaviour is based on religion, there can be no resolution, for there can be no test of truth. Thus, religion is the source of warfare, and of that modern euphemism for warfare, terrorism, and should hang its collective head in shame. Now, admittedly, life is complex, and it may sometimes help to note how people have resolved problems in the past. And to that extent, the collection of anecdotes, allegories, and myths that we call holy books might suggest clues to deportment. But fundamentally, it is better to understand the springs of human behavior through the insight that science brings and elucidate our animal past and the evolutionary pressures that have molded us. And probably the greatest threat to the planet is overpopulation. Science helps to control reproduction, whereas religious zealots, particularly those sitting in Rome, urge us to respect every little sperm as a missile of God's munificence, and thereby rape the earth and sow the seeds of future conflict. In short, unlike science, religion is the spring of conflict. As well as laying the foundations of conflict, religion propagates the worst lie in history, the prospect of life after death. Whereas we might all long for immortality, we know that the only prospect of achieving an approximation to it is through science and its subdivision medicine. The evil lie of post-mortem life, the empty promise of eternal bliss, is based on the potent foundation of fear of personal annihilation, the regret that life can be harsh, and the potency it gives to those who wish to command. Science, noting that there is not one iota of evidence for life after death, except that potent motivator, wishful thinking, rightly scorns the empty proposition of immortality once the physical basis of life has decayed, and clarifies our one and only life as an organic island of consciousness surrounded by a dark, inorganic ocean of non-existence. So, I conclude that as well as science being a better mode of understanding than religion, and there being no parts of reality that science cannot reach, that science is the basis of peace, whereas religion is the root of evil. Now, I think my position has probably become clear, and after due reflection upon my own arguments, I come down in favour of conflict. For only conflict and the elimination of religion can end the intellectual corruption that religion represents and provide a basis for peaceful coexistence of societies. I'm prepared, in some measure, to tolerate peaceful coexistence of science and religion, but only in the sense that I accept that the insane should not be exterminated, but locked away in asylums. It seems to me that the best place for the religious, if they persist in spreading their empty beliefs and the evil that comes in their train, is in some kind of national asylum, perhaps locked away on Holy Island. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Peter. So there we have a sharply formulated thesis. The religion is nothing more than a collection of naive superstitions and delusions which has been superseded by science. I will now ask Keith to reply to that charge.
There already is a national asylum, and it's called Oxford University. We're both members.
It allows us to speak in these ways to one another without hostility or rancour. In thinking about religion and science, of course, one problem is the words are so very general. I mean, what is religion? I've lectured on that for years, and of course, every lecture course ends with saying we don't know. There are so many different things which might be called religion, and nobody quite agrees how to draw the boundaries. So it's not a question of religion doing this or that, it's what sort of religion are you talking about, and what are going to be its very complicated and different sorts of links with the different sorts of natural sciences. Nevertheless, I'll have a go at a definition of some of the great religious traditions, and there are traditions like Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism. Take those well-known, and don't exclude any others, but you have to stop somewhere. That just shows you how very broad religion is. But I think there is a central core of belief in those religious traditions, and I would formulate it like this. There are two parts to it. The first one is a discipline. Religion is a discipline. It's a discipline of the mind, and it's a discipline aimed at overcoming hatred, greed, and ignorance. That is its root cause and its root motivation. So the disciplines of religion, they may not work, but they are intended, and the texts say that they're intended to overcome everything that causes hatred and greed and ignorance. The second part of a religious life in the great religious traditions is experience, an emphasis on experience. And Peter was quite right in saying this experience is not the regular, measurable, quantitative, law-like things which are publicly observable, with which the natural sciences do deal. It's those experiences of a more personal nature about how you see the world, your perspective on it. Peter has a very definite perspective, not a religious one, but not a scientific one either. It's just a way of seeing all the things that he's involved in. And the way of seeing that's involved with religion is this: to see that there is an objectively existing supreme goodness, which is at the root of all reality. That's the fundamental belief, and the aim is to apprehend it, to come into union with it, or at least to know what it is, to have relationship to it. So I think that's the fundamental belief in all these traditions: there is an objective supreme goodness. No one would pretend that there are no problems with this, but of course, if you're doing ethics or moral philosophy, it's a standing question: are ethics objective? Is there any objective truth? And thinkers like J.L. Mackey, whose book is probably still standard, it used to be once upon a time anyway, in ethics, subtitled Inventing Ethics, says, well, everybody naturally thinks that ethics are objective, that is, there really are moral values, moral obligations, but they're wrong. It's an illusion theory. Well, I just put it to you, that's an open question. Whether it's an illusion or not is a natural way to think, and the great saints and teachers of religions claim to have apprehension in a greater degree, a greater intensity than most of us do, of what this supreme goodness is. Now, clearly, different religious traditions will disagree in their take about what is supremely good. But there are various things which are generally agreed, nevertheless, and they are that whatever is supremely good will have the character of wisdom, happiness, compassion, understanding, knowledge, awareness. So they go to constitute what a Buddhist would call nirvana, because I would like to include that concept as well as the supreme good, which is a proper aim of human life, and theists would include God as the supreme end. And when I say supreme end, I mean to apprehend God, just to know God, it's like looking at something supremely beautiful, which satisfies the mind by its mere contemplation. So religion is primarily contemplative in its intent. It wants to apprehend this supreme goodness, which is the reality of God. It wants to do something else as well. It really wants to be in such a relationship to this goodness that that goodness will flow out through those who are devoted to it into the world. The failures of religion, I think, are the failures of people who are religious. And you just have to say, if you're going to start a church, and I've often thought of it myself, or start a new religious organization, it will become corrupt within a couple of years, because they'll start to disagree with people like me. So there's no avoiding corruption. And when Peter suggested we might eliminate religion, a shudder ran through me, because I remember people like Stalin who have tried to do precisely that. And you have to ask the question, really, how are you going to eliminate religion? I would have thought you have to think of some way of dealing with the phenomenon that people have these beliefs, which doesn't just eliminate them. That's not really a good way of proceeding. Let me just repeat those beliefs again. I think at the heart of all the great theistic traditions, and of Buddhism too, as it happens, a discipline to overcome hatred, greed, and ignorance. And you should judge your religious faith by whether it helps to do that or not. An aim at having knowledge of, awareness of, and devotion to that which is of supreme objective beauty. An experience of that and a relationship to it so that your life will be transformed for good. Again, you should judge your religious belief by whether it does that. So I'm clearly not arguing here that any sort of religion, whatever people think it is good. I'm just saying this is the heart of religion. That's what you should judge it by. Always judge the thing you oppose in its best case, not in its worst case. And the best case, of course, is people who are disciplining themselves to become non-egoistic and to have an awareness of a supreme objective goodness. Now, I will admit they may all be deluded. I may indeed be such a member of this national asylum that I'm suffering from great delusions. The other hypothesis, of course, is that Peter is actually religion blind or God blind and is lacking a sensitivity to objective goodness and beauty. The strange thing about it is that he has got such an awareness. Well, I won't get too personal, but I mean, there is one way of looking at religious beliefs which makes them too naive and superficial to be worth thinking about. And I agree, there are religious beliefs like that. I want to go for the best case. I want to go for the great thinkers of religion, and I want to go for the great teachers of religion, and in my own case, Jesus, but I'm happy with Moses and Muhammad, and say these were people who had insight into the nature of reality which can transform human life for good. But if we are tempted to believe that there is such a good and we are wanting to discipline ourselves to become non-egoistic, well, what happens next is going to be up to us, and it may possibly all go wrong. So that's the nature of religion. Now, is there a conflict or a possible conflict between religion and what the sciences say? Well, let me just point out something Karl Popper would have been pleased to hear me say, and that is that if there is no possible conflict between religious and scientific views, then religion isn't making any factual claims. Because whenever anybody makes a factual claim, there is a possible conflict. Obviously, there's a contradictory or contrary position, and that might be true. And I totally agree with Popper that all knowledge in religion, as in science, is provisional. There is no absolute, final, undoubtable knowledge anywhere. So that the religious view is one which says, well, my experience, my belief that there is this objective good and that the mind can be transformed by relationship to it, this belief, I think, is often enough confirmed in the experiences not of the terrorists but of the saints. It's often enough confirmed for me to take it seriously and say that it's worth a practical commitment, the sort of practical commitment that you enter into when you have a life partner. You know, that sort of commitment isn't one that just goes as far as the evidence will show. Right? I think W.K. Clifford's rather famous assertion that it's always and everywhere wrong to believe anything on insufficient evidence hasn't thought about people living together for a long time. My wife did once ask me if I had enough evidence to love her, but there was no reply to that. Really. It's a commitment. You make these commitments. They're very important in morality, in economics. Why not in the big life questions about how I'm really going to live and what my life's to be about? Well, let me mention three areas of conflict that are possible and where conflicts, of course, are actual from time to time. But my argument will simply be that many forms of religion, certainly the one I hold, and I think many other forms of religious belief too, successfully overcome these conflicts, or in fact even use science in very creative ways. First sort of possible conflict is this: what's the general character of the universe? Now, Peter has a particular view about this, though it's quite hard to make out, but it's probably in the end that the universe exists by some sort of inner mathematical necessity, but an alternative view might be it just exists by accident, right? It just happens to be there. And I know that the Astronomer Royal has just written a very nice little book about the cosmos, and he says, well, in the end, you've just got two beliefs about the universe. One is that it is in fact so beautiful and elegant in its basic structure and so well fitted for the development of organic life forms that there must be some sort of cosmic intelligence. That's one hypothesis, he says. But he doesn't accept that one. He says the other one is that every possible universe exists and therefore this one is no surprise. Because there's clearly one possible universe. Well, now he prefers that one. That is the existence of the multiverse, which has every possible universe connected up to it. Well, which is the simpler hypothesis? I don't want to insist on it. I don't want to say it's obvious, but I'll choose God. I'll say cosmic intelligence is, of course, the simpler hypothesis. But, and this is tremendously important, religion is not about explaining the universe. That's not what it's about. It's about disciplining the mind, overcoming the self, and achieving unity with the objective good. That doesn't explain the universe. What you have to do is to say, is that notion of an objective good underlying the universe, is it plausible in the light of what the sciences say? And that involves questions like, well, is the process of evolution purposive? Does it have any direction? Well, to cut a long argument very short, Simon Conway Morris, who was a professor of a new and improbable subject called evolutionary paleobiology in Cambridge, has just written a book called Life's Solution, in which he argues on purely scientific grounds, he says, that in fact there is a direction in the evolution process such that organic conscious life forms are bound to exist sooner or later as long as the general cosmic environment allows them to do so. That is, unless they're all destroyed as soon as they begin, there's a biological convergence because of the structure of carbon and lots of complicated arguments. Anyway, there is such an argument. So from within the sciences themselves, it is not at all a disreputable belief to say that it looks as though the evolutionary process has a direction. And the direction is, as T.H. Huxley said, and he was no great religious believer, in the direction of complexity, integration, and the material universe taking control over its own future, at least to some extent. So that if there's a direction, it is that because of the peculiar structure of hydrogen, helium, and carbon, and the particular ways in which they bind together, DNA becomes possible, central nervous systems become possible, consciousness becomes possible. And of course, the traditional religious view in all the Semitic traditions, Jewish, Christian, and Islamic, is that human beings are pieces of matter which have become intelligently conscious, self-aware, and capable of directing parts of their environment. It is not the idea there's a separate soul which gets injected into this. When I wrote a book called Defending the Soul, I was defending that fundamentally Aristotelian and Semitic view of what the human soul is. That is, it's a chunk of matter which has become intelligent and morally responsible. Well, you could argue from a scientific point of view that the universe looks as though it could well be directed to that end. As I say, God is not going to explain this. All I'm concerned to say is that it's a possibility, and I think advances in quantum mechanics recently have made this possibility much more telling. If I can just quote Despagnat, a Nobel laureate, a quantum mechanist, he says what we have is a veiled reality. That is to say, the nature of the material world, of what matter is, has become totally impossible to imagine. As Feinberg said, anybody who thinks they understand quantum mechanics is lying. Perhaps they're religious. But anyway, you can't understand it, so perhaps Michael can, but even then Michael would probably say, no, we don't know what it is that the quantum equations actually represent. Now that view doesn't say, oh, it must be God. It's not like that at all. You're just saying, well, the scientific world doesn't really any longer talk about chunks of matter which just bump into each other, become very complicated and turn into human beings. The scientific worldview now says, well, things are much more complicated. One last quotation from a scientist, Roger Penrose, my colleague in Oxford, professor of mathematics, said that probably all the laws of physics will need to be changed to take account of quantum reality and of that other great total mystery, consciousness. So we're in a world where we don't have a hard materialist view. Just at the point where hard materialists are beginning to shout, the whole theory of matter has collapsed totally, and we don't really know what it is. Paul Davis has even said, matter is a myth. And when you get down to what it is that underlies the interconnected, entangled, non-local quantum world, you have to say, actually, I don't know. Now, that doesn't make you religious. It just means you haven't got a strong argument against that objective reality, which is beyond the equations that we have in our physical sciences. So that's about the general nature of the universe. So to my mind, the verdict would come out, probably there is a cosmic intelligence of some sort. But I'm willing to be agnostic, because what I really want to say is there's no good argument in science against such an objectively existing aware good being. Rather quickly now, I think I'll have to finish, and so I'll just finish by saying, of course, looking at the Bible or the Quran, for example, there are certain things whose interpretation has had to change, but it hasn't been such a shock. I mean, the Genesis account of a six-day creation is clearly false. But of course, what religious believers will say is that that view is myth. It is a way, in a very pre-scientific culture, of saying what the relationship, the important relationship between human life and that ultimate reality of consciousness and spirit, what that relationship is. And this story was the best way to do it at the time. So I think all theologians in Britain, anyway, agree with that. It is an adjustment. I mean, if religion didn't change, it wouldn't be worth very much. So, of course, we don't want to go back to religions which have become outdated. We want to say, well, you have to take the scientific view and let it modify your religion. Last point, miracles. Well, miracles don't come within the province of scientific explanation because, of course, they are, by definition, things which cannot be scientifically explained because they only happen at times when the scientific laws do not explain what's going on. So they're by definition not encompassable in a general nomological law-like type of explanation. Could they happen? Well, I've never seen any good argument why not. David Hume's worst ever book was the one in which he talked about miracles, and it's just the worst philosophical book I've read in my life. And of course, in the end, he says, well, the only reason for not believing in miracles is that they don't happen. Now, that's not a good argument, actually. You do need, if there are people who claim to have experienced events which transcend the normal regularities of events, which don't fall under general laws, and which do, from a religious point of view, seem to show something about the ultimate character and purpose of reality, well, that is something which science can neither say yes or no about. It's a matter of personal experience. So a miracle is requires a personal form of explanation. Why did it happen? For what reason? What was the motive? And again, I have no idea how to explain that. It's not a question of explaining. I would say I do believe that there is spiritual causality in the universe. That is, there are causal chains into which intentions and knowledge enter in a way that is not reducible to other forms of non-mental explanation. So again, all I'm wanting, let me just end by saying, religion is not about explanation, it's about discipline and experience. What you need from science is a view which is consonant with that, and perhaps which tends towards it. And my own verdict on this would be, well, the sciences in general are very conducive to belief that there is a cosmic intelligence in existence. The problems that remain are problems we all have, whatever our beliefs. How does mind relate to matter? How does spirit relate to matter? How does freedom relate to necessity? As a philosopher, I'm very glad to know that I haven't solved these problems and that my students still have work to do and always will.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Keith. So now we have two clear positions laid out for you, from the scientist and the theological perspective. If you want to settle an argument, the best way, of course, is to consult a philosopher. And for that reason, I've invited Peter Lipton to be our third speaker.
Actually, I would have thought that the best way to prolong an argument is to consult a philosopher. I want to begin by making two confessions, though one of them has really already been made for me by Michael. And the first is that I come to this as a philosopher, more specifically as a philosopher of science. And the second confession I have is that I also come to this from a particular religious tradition. I'm Jewish, and I think it's important that I tell you that, because when you see the position I adopt, you may well feel that that's a position that is more attractive in a Jewish context or in some context than in others, though I won't be talking specifically about any one religion. But since I have this Jewish background, I do want to begin by telling you a little story. This is a story from Eastern Europe in the 18th century. Two Jewish businessmen were having a commercial dispute, and they couldn't settle it. So they went to the rabbinical court for a ruling to the rabbi in the community. And they went into the room. The rabbi was there, surrounded by all his disciples. And the first man explained his side of the story. And the rabbi thought for a while, and then he said, "You're right." And then that man left, well pleased. Then the second man in the dispute came in, and he explained his side of the argument. And the rabbi thought for a while, and he said, "You're right." And then he left, also pleased. Then one of the rabbi's disciples came up to him and said, "But Rabbi, how can that be? These two people had incompatible positions. They can't possibly both be right." And the rabbi said, "You're right too." And that's a little bit how I feel batting third in this lineup. I want to say that Peter Atkins is right. At least I agree with him that science is our best shot at explaining the world, at understanding what it contains, at understanding how it works. Of course, I don't agree with everything Peter says. It wouldn't be fun if I did. For example, I don't agree with him that the human intellect is capable of complete understanding. That seems to me rather unlikely. I don't see why our mind should be so perfectly attuned with the universe that we can understand every bit of it. And I don't think it's a particularly scientific view to take the view that we are capable of complete understanding unless you turn that into a kind of tautology. But I also think that Keith is right. At least I'm very sympathetic to the emphasis that he places on religious commitment, although, as you'll see, I construe the notion of commitment perhaps a bit differently from the way he does. Of course, I don't agree with everything he said either. For example, I think the human inquiry concerning human understanding by David Hume is one of the greatest books in the history of Western philosophy. So we have a slight disagreement there. But I want to sketch my own view. I said I'm a philosopher of science, but since I'm in a department where I'm surrounded by historians as well as other philosophers, I do want to make one preliminary historical remark. And that is, I think it's very common to see an image of the history of science and the history of religion as one of fairly consistent conflict. And I just want to say that as far as I can tell from my historian friends, that is not a very accurate image of the actual history of science. If you look at the actual history of Western science, what I think one would rather find is that certainly up to the period of perhaps as late as 1800, science and religion were predominantly seen as partners. Many scientists thought religion was terrifically important. It might be important because it gave you a basis for putting trust in your empirical inferences, which are always going way beyond the data you have. It was also important because many of the natural philosophers before the year 1800 saw their empirical inquiry as a fundamentally religious form of inquiry. Certainly that seems to be the case with someone like Newton, just to pick a dramatic example. He wrote in the Principia, "It is the business of natural philosophy to discourse of God from the phenomena." And it's arguable that some of his central concepts of his physics were essentially theological, that he saw force as the will of God or the manifestation of the will of God. He saw the universe as a whole as God's sensorium. And he didn't just say that stuff. Newton was obsessed with religious matters and wrote, I believe, thousands of pages of theology. He had rather unusual Christian views. He was anti-Trinitarian, but very serious about his religion. All right, that's all the history I'm going to do. What I want to do is I want to talk about a way of resolving the conflict between science and religion. Because I think there is a conflict at the level of doctrine, and there is a conflict at the level of, if you like, evidential standards. I think it's a mistake to reduce either science or religion to doctrine. Both science and religion are much more than that. They are elaborate social activities. But at the level of doctrine, there is, I think, a prima facie conflict, and that's what I want to focus on. And the way I want to focus on it is by looking at the philosophy of science. Because if you look at what philosophers of science have to say about science, what they do is they give you options. There's more than one way to understand the aims of science. And I'm just going to mention two ways. The first way is perhaps the most natural way, and that is the view that science is in the truth business. Science is in the business of telling us more and more about a largely unobservable and mind-independent reality. That's not to say that science doesn't change and science doesn't make mistakes or that all the claims of science are equally sure. But it is to say that we are discovering more and more about that mind-independent world. That's the realist view. But it's not the only view you can take about science. And I want to contrast that realist view with a version of what is often called instrumentalism. And that's the view that we should view scientific theories not as maps of reality, but rather as computers, as tools, as ways of making more and more accurate predictions about the observable aspects of reality. So the particular version of instrumentalism I want to sketch for you is called constructive empiricism, and it's developed by the Princeton philosopher, though originally Dutch, Bas van Frassen. What van Frassen says is, like the realist, we should interpret scientific theories literally. If the theory talks about invisible particles, that's what the theory is talking about. We shouldn't try and reinterpret the science. We should take the claims of the theory at face value. But we should make a distinction between the claims that the theory makes about what is observable and the claims that the theory makes about what we cannot observe. And we should, corresponding to that distinction, make a distinction in our cognitive attitude towards those different parts of the theory. What he says is you shouldn't ever believe that a scientific theory is true. Rather, you should simply accept that your best scientific theories are empirically adequate. What that means, he's using accept here in his own sense, what that means is you should believe that what it says about the observable world is correct, and you should be agnostic about the rest of the theory's claims. The rest of the theory has a literal meaning, but by accepting that theory, you're committing yourself to using the theory, not to believing that what the theory says is true when it talks about the unobservable. But he combines that partial agnosticism about scientific theories with another attitude, and that is what he calls immersion. What he says is when the scientist is working within her theory, she is immersed in the world of that theory. And she thinks herself as if the theory were true all the way down. She gets into that invisible world, and it's an extremely useful way of thinking. You do better science that way. And realists sometimes say the same thing, because realists also have to admit that in science we often have to use models that we know are strictly speaking false. In one context, we'll have to treat the fluid as a continuous medium if we want to get good results. In another context, we'll treat the fluid as made up of discrete particles. We may immerse ourselves first in the one, immersing oneself in the fluid, I hadn't thought of that, immerse ourselves first in the one model and then in the other, get inside the world of the model in order to do good science, but actually we don't believe either model. Well, that's the general idea behind instrumentalism. Scientific theories are good to think with. They're good for solving problems, and they can do that work without requiring that you believe their full content. Now, what would it be to look for analogs of those two attitudes, realism on the one hand and instrumentalism on the other hand, in the case of religion? Well, the realist case is pretty easy to work out. That would be some kind of fundamentalism. It would be taking the statements in your own holy text literally, not taking them to be metaphorical, taking them literally, and it would be believing them to be literally true of a world that is quite independent of us. What would it be to be an instrumentalist about religion? Well, as in the case of scientific instrumentalism, or the version that I've sketched for you, the version I have in mind for religion would again take the religious doctrine literally. You don't say, oh, it's all just a metaphorical way of describing nature. when it says Moses divided the Red Sea so the Israelites could cross on dry land, it means, weirdly enough, that Moses divided the Red Sea so the Israelites could walk on dry land. But just because you take the claims literally, you understand their meaning literally, doesn't mean that you have to believe that they are true. You can take all sorts of other cognitive attitudes towards those literal statements. And I think you can take a cognitive attitude that is roughly, and I say only roughly, analogous to what von Frassen calls acceptance. That is, you get inside the religious world, you immerse yourself in those texts, but you don't have to believe the central claims of that religion to get the value out of it. You immerse yourself in the text and you derive various benefits. The idea here is that a religious tradition can be good for thinking with, that you can get certain advantages from doing that. Now, to some extent, it seems to me the advantages that you can get from doing that are partially a matter of historical accident. I know in my own case, one of the great values of religion for me is a kind of identification, a kind of solidarity with a certain group of people, many dead and some living, that I want to identify with. And it is a historical accident that those ancestors used these texts. They might well have ended up using other texts. But because those are the texts that they use to think with, I want to use those texts as well. That doesn't mean I accept what any of those texts say blindly in the sense of believing what they say, but it means that I think hard through them, and I do accept some of their consequences. For example, there are ritual consequences in every religious tradition. Those rituals can be very important to the people in that tradition, as forms of identification and solidarity and as ways of thinking through the life's difficult problems. And my suggestion is you can have that without having to believe that the religious dogma is true. So, why bother with an instrumentalist view either of science or religion? Well, the answer is you become an instrumentalist in either case because you think, first of all, that's all you're entitled to. In the case of science, it's because you think we don't really have the right to believe these very exotic claims about unobservable particles and phenomena. In the case of religion, it's because you don't think there is good reason to believe that these supernatural claims are literally true. And secondly, you become an instrumentalist in science or in religion, not just because you believe it's all you're entitled to, but also because you believe it's all you need. That you can get the advantages, for example, in the case of science, the technological advantages of science, without having to stick your neck out further. And I've suggested that one could also take the view that one can get many of the advantages of religious commitment without having to actually believe that these claims are true. So that gives one rather more options in understanding the question of the conflict between science and religion. Now, my own preference, having given you a menu, let me just end by telling you what my personal preference is. My personal preference, but I think it's more than a personal preference, I think there are arguments for it too, is to be a realist about science. I think science does give us reason to believe more than what it says about the observable. And, as you will have guessed, I'm attracted to an instrumentalist view of religion. Now, in that combination, what happened to the conflict? Well, at the level of statements, the conflict still exists because I'm construing both discourses literally and they are saying more or less some contradictory things. But at the level of my belief, I have consistency because I am working with more statements than I believe, and the subset that is my belief forms, I'm hoping, a consistent set. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Peter. Now we're going to come on to the actual debate, part of the debate. But while you're collecting your thoughts, I thought I might just address one question to each of the speakers, just to set the ball rolling, so to speak. Now, first of all, we started with Peter Atkins, and he's made the point that there's no purpose in the universe, that it's a kind of pointless thing. And I could respond to that by saying, well, science on that account is just some sort of shorthand for description, but does it really confer understanding in the sense that purposes often do in ordinary day explanations? For example, in answer to the question, why did I agree to take part in the proper debate, I think people want to have the purpose of converting the audience to your point of view or something like that. So if you allow purposes in some areas of explanation, why do you think it not at all appropriate in the context of the point of the whole universe?
I think you have to distinguish between personal purpose, which is to find a fun way of getting through one's brief moment of life without treading on too many toes, I suppose, and distinguish it from cosmic purpose. They're in two entirely different aspects of the universe, that we are choosing beings, that we go out into our lives, and we have a series of decisions to take, and those involve acknowledging that we have a particular purpose in getting through the day. It's an entirely different question from the underlying purpose of the cosmos, which there is not one jot of evidence, and completely outside any need. The universe can get on quite well without any purpose.
Right. So perhaps I can now turn to Keith. And it seems to me that you're relying in distinguishing science and religion, the contrast between evidence and experience, what you might call evidentialism, that science is based on some sort of objective agreement, anyway at the level of observation, against a subjective type of experience that seems to ground religious belief. Well, here one's question would be, I suppose, how does one guard against spurious experiences, delusional, drug-induced, and so forth? Because you haven't got the kind of objective agreement at the level of observation to fall back on. You're always at the level of subjective experience. So how do you tell what you might call genuine experience from some mad delusional and so forth? How do you get the drift of the point?
It's not too difficult, in fact, because you can identify a mad delusional experience by the fact it says things you clearly know to be false. I mean, there's evidence, like being carried off in a flying saucer, for example. And so they're mad by the standards of most intelligent and instructive people would think. And it's the same in religion, really. There are traditions of rational intelligibility, and there are traditions of moral superiority. So the sorts of judgments you have to make about religion are like the sorts of judgments you make about whether someone is suffering delusions in general or whether they're doing something that is immoral. And I think religious traditions do make these distinctions. And just to take an obvious example, militant Islamic terrorists are absolutely condemned by traditional and contemporary Islam in general because they fail to meet the moral demands of the Quran itself. And so the tradition is laying down moral and rational criteria, which are those we use in life in general.
Right. Well, let me turn finally to Peter Lipton just for a preliminary question. Science yields explanations which are validated by the canons of scientific rationality. Now, part of these canons are to respect empirical adequacy, and that's the kind of observational level where you can arguably get some sort of agreement. I mean, in some cases you may not get agreement, but it's any arguable, there's a kind of level at which you can get agreement. But beyond that, there are what are sometimes called the pragmatic virtues of explanation, for example, by people like Van Frost, who have already been mentioned, wishing to emphasize that there's no connection here with truth. And these pragmatic virtues are things like simplicity and unifying power and that sort of thing. Well, Peter Lipton, a rather nice way of talking about this distinction, he talks about the loveliness of explanation to capture these pragmatic virtues. But the question that I've got, would just like to press him a little bit, is the question of whether loveliness is a guide to truth. I mean, do we really live in the most lovely of all possible worlds, to paraphrase Leibniz? It could be that the world actually isn't simple, but is very complicated. And it's not clear that science can ever really adjudicate that without introducing some sort of canon of scientific rationality. Yeah. And beyond that, I would just like to raise the question of how Peter would want to rate religious explanations on the loveliness scale.
Right, well, that's a brief question. I should be able to handle that. The first part of Michael's question isn't really specifically about religion. It's about this connection between loveliness and likeliness. And this is one of the reasons that I love that book by Hume, because Hume really made this problem pressing. What Hume points out in non-Humean terms is that no matter how much data you have for your scientific theory, those data always radically underdetermine the theory you endorse, by which I mean that there are always, in principle, many other theories incompatible with each other, but all compatible with your data. And that's no matter how much data you've got. So that raises the problem of how you can have any confidence in any one of those theories over any other one. And that's why these other virtues are often brought in. So, and scientists themselves often talk about a preference for simplicity, which they take to be not merely pragmatic, but to be a sign of truth. They think it's more likely that the simpler empirically adequate theory is correct or close to correct than a less simple empirically adequate theory. And I agree with Michael that we seem absolutely to depend on these additional principles. And I also am afraid, this is a bit disappointing here, agree with him that it is terribly difficult to provide a non-circular justification for those preferences. So I think this is just the kind of central problem in the philosophy of science. From the point of view of the practicing scientist, it's very different. From the point of view of the practicing scientist, she feels extremely lucky if she can come up with even one theory that is empirically adequate. But the logical point remains. In principle, there are always, always many other ways you could have skinned that cat. Now, what was the other question? The other question was about religion.
Well, it was how you rate religious
explanations. How lovely are religious explanations? So what I argue in my book, In Inference to the Best Explanation, which is what Michael is alluding to, is that, in fact, in science and in everyday life, we do often use loveliness as a guide to likeliness. That is, we have the data, and we ask ourselves which of the explanations we can come up with would, if correct, provide the greatest understanding. And we will tend to judge that the one that would provide the greatest understanding is also the one that is likeliest to be correct. And that raises the question that Michael asked. But I think as a description of how people think, it's correct, however difficult it may be to justify that way of thinking. Now, how lovely are religious explanations? I think part of the problem is that loveliness is a multidimensional thing. And I think on some dimensions, if you take religious explanations to be explanations of physical phenomena, they're often not terribly lovely, because they are, this happened, X occurred, because God willed that X would occur. And that is a style of explanation, which even when it's true, of course it's often true. The reason I've come to the debate tonight is because I wanted to come to the debate tonight. That is correct, but it is not very illuminating. So I think sometimes religious explanations don't do very well on that front. But as I suggested in my initial presentation, I don't think the main value of religion is in explaining natural phenomena. I think the main value of religion is that it gives us a way of thinking about our tradition, of our place in the universe, of our values, in a way that helps us think through those issues.
Well, those are just some preliminary points, but now I'm going to throw it open to the floor. We've got some roving microphones, both down on the ground floor and also up in the balcony. And so if you'd like to just indicate you want to make a question or a short statement, perhaps you do so, and perhaps you give your name as well, so we just know who's asking the questions. So, well, I see Talal Debs has got your hand up.
Hi, this is just a question for Peter Lipton. I really like the little menu you gave us. And I can see you can alleviate some tension by being an instrumentalist about religion and being a realist about, is that the way you did it? Yeah, a realist about science. And you could also go the other way and be a realist about religion and an instrumentalist about science. But I'm wondering if you haven't sort of stacked the deck against the person who wants to be a realist about both. What do you feel about, is that a real option on your menu?
Well, I think it's a difficult option to take. I mean, one from column A and one from column B, but I think that's a difficult combination. Certainly, it's difficult for me to see how you do that if you hold on to the other component that I held constant across the menu, and that was a non-metaphorical but a literal understanding of both scientific and religious discourse. I think if you insist on that literal interpretation, there is conflict there, and I don't know how to get rid of it. So if you wanted to be a realist about both, I think you'd probably be driven back to a highly metaphorical understanding of one area or the other, perhaps more likely a highly metaphorical understanding of religion. And I don't want to go that way. And the reason I don't want to go that way is a little bit like if you read a novel, you may get enormous things out of that novel. You don't believe it. You know it's a novel. But it helps you to think about your own life. But if you said, oh, that novel isn't really about those people who are having all those difficulties and working through it, but it's just a metaphor for the color of the sky, right? You would lose the value of the novel. Similarly, I think if you just try and avoid the conflict problem by saying, oh, all this God talk, it's just metaphorical talk for nature. Nothing supernatural there. I think you'd lose a lot of the value of immersing yourself in a religious tradition.
Now we've got Professor here in the middle there, right in the middle of the fifth, sixth row.
A long way from the microphone.
down that row. That's right, down that row.
Thank you. On.
Now it is.
Yes. Peter Atkins said that science can you turns its gaze. Now it seems to me that if we're talking about the human world and how we live and the kind of concepts by which we guide our lives, I would say on the contrary, science occludes wherever it turns its gaze and the human world falls away. Now take a sort of hackneyed example. Tell me all about the pigments and chemical structure of the Mona Lisa painting, but it can tell me nothing about the smile or the enigma or the meaning of that smile. Equally, if we think of, take a topical example, movements place outside the walls of Troy, we can talk about the nobility of Hector and the way that his actions were guided by patriotism, by love of his. Compare that with the might of Achilles and his brutality, similar movements. Now, I don't think that any of those kind of level of explanation can be explained in terms either of brain mechanisms or indeed of evolutionary strategies. So I'm being assertive because I've only got about a half a minute to speak, that we have a level of discourse here which is not reducible to science and therefore would only be distorted and occluded if you tried to give it a scientific explanation. I want to go on and say that some of these notions like nobility, brutality and so on are not just projections, they are real objective values. And the question that religion raises, though it doesn't necessarily solve, so I'm a sort of convergent coexistence person, is whether these objective properties in our world, whether they are reflections of the way the universe is, and whether there is a sort of divine or human face behind the universe, or whether these notions that we have are simply chance occurrences which the universe makes no response or whatever. And I don't think actually that science can say anything on that question, because I think it leaves everything as it is.
Well, I think that question's addressed to you, Peter, in the first instance, and then perhaps Keith for what's coming.
The trouble with being in an audience of philosophers is that they're all such pessimists. And I think if one were to look for a litmus test for a philosopher to distinguish him, or as Peter Lipton would say, her, from a scientist, one would look at the degree of pessimism and optimism that they expose. I think scientists are optimists. philosophers are pessimists, raising objections, saying that science will not go down this corridor, science will not be able to answer this question, science will not be able to do this, as we have been hearing from the way that you expressed yourself a moment ago. I think what distinguishes science from other forms of knowledge is its cautious, careful probing. It doesn't rush in where other fools go. So instead of thinking that to understand Hector's motivation, we don't sit back and say, ah, it must be some universal gift that he's responding to. We think, is it in his psychology? Is it in the human psyche, let's call it that? Is it in the evolutionary history of our species? Can we try to understand? Can we work towards an understanding of a person's nobility in terms of the psychology and the physiology of the brain? I see nothing wrong with that. I admit that at present there is no science of aesthetics, so we cannot take a meter up to Mona Lisa's smile and get 9 on the scale or whatever. But I don't think that precludes a theory of aesthetics, although it may be a long way off. We can understand little bits about the pleasing sounds, why a major third is attractive, whereas a dissonance is not. We can begin to see why looking at a particular shape might have a pleasing effect because it's of its physiological component. We're atomizing the problem. We're not trying to rush in and say we understand why a particular picture is wonderful or why a particular personality was noble, but we are edging towards it, and you must give us time, you must be patient. I'm confident, being a scientist and therefore an optimist, will edge towards an understanding, and it won't be some kind of cosmic beam in from the universe.
Do you want to come in on that, Peter?
Well, I suppose I would feel if you could get a fairly tight definition of scientific explanation, there would have to be, by definition, some things which fell outside it. You can't have a definition which covers absolutely everything. So I think it must be tautologically true that if there is a specific meaning for scientific explanation, you could state something which fell outside that. Otherwise, it would be so general as to be virtually useless. And most of us are accepting a general view. I mean, not all sciences are the same by any means, but a general view that science is concerned with law-like, quantifiable explanations which are utterly regular and predictable. And of course, the economic and social sciences, for which this college is so famous, can't come up with things like that. Are they sciences?
Well, of course they are.
Yes, but they're not the sort of science which physics is or chemistry is. So,
well, thank you very much, Keith. Now we have a question from Dr. Saunders, who's sitting next to my wife, actually, in the third row.
The third row, yeah.
Thank you. I come back to Peter Lipton's very interesting parallel that he draws, but I don't think you can have it quite so easy.
Point the microphone towards you.
Right. Recall that part of constructive empiricism, the platform there is that, or the belief and the goal of science is to get it right on the observable. Okay. So presumably, the instrumentalist a la Bas van Traassen about religion will be something like get it right about moral values, for example. I mean, I'm not sure, because you didn't actually say, but let's take that as an example. But then surely the debate is only just beginning, the issue of conflict or peaceful coexistence, because if I understand Peter Atkins rightly, and I think I agree with him on this, these are competitive analyses that are being offered, competitive accounts, explanations, and so on, of things like moral value, of how to live peacefully, for example. One is exactly in the realm of conflicting systems that are going to approach, attempt to give accounts and conflicting accounts of one and the same set of phenomena. So I suppose my question is, can you really hold this up as a framework for peaceful coexistence? Is it not, on the contrary, a framework for continued conflict?
Okay, Simon, thanks for that. I mean, this is a big subject, and you're pointing to a crucial issue for me. The general crucial issue is, how strong is the analogy between constructive empiricism in science and the analog in the case of religion? I can only make a few comments now, and I haven't thought it through enough either. But I think that one of the aspects of constructive empiricism that's worth emphasizing here is that, in principle, the constructive empiricist does not have to limit, I'll say himself this time, to a single consistent theory. Right? A constructive empiricist can have inconsistent theoretical beliefs, as long as he doesn't mix them together too much, and use them for different purposes, a la, as an analogy at least, the different models one might have for fluid motion. So I emphasize that you are not going to eliminate conflict at the doctrinal level. Rather, all I'm trying to do is to eliminate conflict at the level of what I actually believe. Now, let me say something in particular about the moral consequences, because my position there is delicate. I mean, maybe too delicate for me. I do think we want to draw moral consequences from our religious tradition, but I certainly do not want to say that we're going to blindly accept those consequences, whatever we say about the rest of our tradition. But of course, in the scientific case, von Frassen is not saying, come up with any old theory, deduce an observable consequence, and believe that observable consequence, right? You test the theory and you modify it to get something better. Now, I think to some extent, the same sort of thing is possible in the religious case. That is, we draw certain moral consequences from our religious tradition, and then we have to test those. Now, we cannot test them empirically in the way you can test straightforward empirical claims, but we test them in any way that any of us could agree moral disputes should be resolved. We engage in what's sometimes called a process of reflective equilibrium, for example. So we evaluate those moral claims. Now, if we decide that some of the moral claims in our tradition are unacceptable, as I certainly do in my own tradition, one possibility is to modify that tradition. And that's something I also do in my tradition, because I'm not an Orthodox Jew. But I do want to emphasize that, on my view, you can't even accept the moral consequences just because your tradition says so. You have to engage in some kind of independent evaluation.
Well, we've got lots of people wanting to ask questions. First of all, Professor Worrell, right at the back in the balcony, on the right-hand side, next to the door.
Because I'm frightened of Michael, I'll do what he asked everybody to do, but no, so far, haven't done. My name is John Worrell from LSE. So just a couple of comments really on Peter, and then a question to Keith Ward. It does seem to me that religion, a constructive empiricist version of religion, is no religion at all. So I'm happy to welcome you on my side, although I would like to invite you to identify with humanity in general rather than, I don't mean this to sound aggressive, but rather than this sort of tribalism, which I think leads to the sorts of, as we all know, can lead to some of the problems that Peter was talking about. But anyway, that's a minor thing in a way. I really wanted to press Keith Ward on his answer to Michael's question, because this does seem to be the heart of it. As far as I can see, there's no necessary conflict between scientific claims and religious claims, precisely because the religious people can move towards at least the sort of empty position that Peter's suggesting, cognitively empty. Where there is conflict is at the level of scientific method. I mean, and this brings us back to Clifford, who was rather summarily dismissed. It seems to me that Clifford's view that one should adjust one's beliefs entirely to the evidence for them is a very good precept to hold. And the thing about evidence, as construed in science, as several people have mentioned, is that it's intersubjective. I mean, the needle points to more or less 5 on the scale for everybody. The computer printout reads 1001 for everybody. Everybody gets blown up if an atom bomb falls in their region. But this notion of experiencing as, it seems to me, is essentially subjective. I mean, I assume that Scientologists experience the world Scientologically, whatever this means. Your answer to Michael's question seemed to me just to be the letting the majority win. It turns out that we let tradition decide what's sensible and what's not. But I don't see any, that seems to me just a question of voting. It seems to me that the person who believes that the statue really did shed blood from its eyes or whatever is just as crazy, in my view, just as deluded as the person, after all, there are quite a lot of people who believe in flying saucers and so on. I mean, it seems to me a cop-out to say, well, we all know that these sort of crazy, as far as I'm concerned, crazy religious claims are non-delusional because there are large numbers of people who believe them and the tradition endorses them. Now, there's no reason to think there won't be, well, there is a long-standing UFO tradition. I mean, it may be rather small, but people go on believing this. And it does seem to me that we've, in the end, got to come down to the evidence. There's no evidence that there are UFOs, and there's no evidence in the proper sense that there are that any of the miracles talked about in various religious faiths are veridical.
Keith, would you like to?
Okay, this gives me the opportunity to apologize if I gave the impression that I didn't think Hume's Inquiry was a great philosophy book. I do, but the appendix on miracles is, just happens to be terrible. But the book itself is wonderful. Now, on subjectivity, I think the words subjective and objective are very, very difficult. And if you mean by subjective, I just think what I want because I make it up, I absolutely have no interest in that at all. And if you use the word intersubjective, then of course you have to have an idea of the group which you're taking. It could be the whole human race. I mean, that's a possibility. But I don't think the whole human race believes that quantum theory is true, though perhaps they ought to. So if you have to say, what is my peer group? If physicists of my acquaintance get letters every day disproving Einstein's theory of relativity, they never take any notice of them at all because their peer group tells them not to. There is a lot of authority in science. As anybody who does a physics degree knows, you just believe what you're told for quite a long time and probably forever. And you take that on authority because this peer group, a very small number of people probably really understand the stuff, you think they're really the experts, they're the authorities I should follow. So there is a difference, of course, because religion is, I think, not about looking for laws which explain physical events, really. But it does involve accepting a peer group which you think is reliable in reporting certain sorts of experiences. So it's not, intersubjective doesn't help very much, because what you want to know is, what's the structure of authority? Who would be a reputable authority? Now, if you think nobody in religion would, I don't think you've studied the data very carefully.
Well, could you make a quick comeback, John? Yep.
Quantum mechanics, I'm really talking about the evidence. I mean, you know, the needle pointing to five. It's the tests that are really the important thing, and that just is intersubjective. I mean, so long as you're not drunk, everybody sees that the needle points to five, that the computer readout is 011, that the line in the cloud chamber bifurcates at this point. And that's the sort of things that are the hard, what, all the crazy stuff about theory-ladenness of evidence. This is the hard nuggets against which our claims in science are tested.
Why should I deny anything that is so discovered? But in fact, I have just been at a conference of archaeologists in France, and they disagreed with absolute venom on the dating of certain images in caves, and they had good evidence. But of course, what they were arguing about was, is this laboratory reputable? Who runs the laboratory? I think she's perfectly trustworthy. And everybody else would say, no, she's not. I think she's made lots of mistakes. You should have sent it to another laboratory. It's not quite as simple as the needle points to three.
But it can go back to the laboratory, and it can be tested, and agreement can be reached, whereas your views cannot be tested at all.
Now, there are a lot of people who want to join in the discussion, so could we move on to Ioannis Botsis, who's the next person. Over here, Ioannis.
Yeah. This question is for Peter Lipton. You made this analogy with Van Frassen's work on instrumentalism, and I mean, the most important thing there is saving the phenomena. And in fact, other people in the scientific realism debate take that as a minimal constraint, that a theory must save the phenomena. And my question was, being instrumentalist with respect to religious beliefs and texts and religion, what is it that that kind of instrumentalism saves? And why that kind of thing that it saves, which you seem to be saying that it's a tradition that's important, why is it that we need religion? Why can't we just stay with the tradition and save the tradition, but not any of the religious elements?
Well, I mean, in a way, I think you could construe what I've been saying as problematizing the distinction you've just made between the religion and the tradition. I mean, a crude version of what I've said is that all you need is the tradition. I mean, that for me is the religion. But I did also suggest, and I agree with you, and this is related to Simon's question as well, that the religious tradition does not yield empirical predictions in the way that a scientific theory does. So you're not looking for the religious tradition to save the phenomena in the same way. I think that's an important disanalogy. But the reason that I think that it's still useful to make the comparison is because of the way von Frassen combines literal semantics, literal meaning, with less than belief, and the way he emphasizes the role of immersion. I wanted to draw all of that. But I do think there are some consequences of the religious tradition that you do accept. And I'm thinking a lot of these, I mean, I talked a little bit about the tentative moral acceptance of certain normative claims, but a lot of the consequences of my own religious tradition are in the form really of injunctions, and a lot of them are ritual. They're what you might refer to as the tradition. They're forms of behavior you're enjoined to follow. And one can accept those if one is in the tradition. That, for me, is what it is to be in that tradition or engaged fully with that tradition.
Now, next is Professor Sarabji, the fourth row on the, just right where you are. There we are.
Is this on and audible? It's on, isn't it? All right, good. I just wanted to suggest what might be called an eclectic approach to the question, because it seems to me to make a difference what question you're asking, whether you're likely to get an answer from science or religion. I was brought up absolutely fascinated by science, and I still am. But on historical questions, I would expect it to play an extremely minor role. Why did the Roman Empire last so long? Or what's going to happen in Iraq now? Science might have a tiny role in that, but it seems to me to be the wrong discipline to throw much light on it. This is not an aesthetic question, and this is a factual question. What's going to happen in Iraq now? I just wouldn't expect science to answer, nor religion for that matter. I think religious parties may be at fault for the mess that's going on there at the moment, but that isn't going to help us to predict what's going to happen next. Take another question, which is important in a completely different way, to many people at least. Do you have a true self? Or are you a true self? There's a question which quite a lot of people have a strong view about or feel is very important to them. Now, here's a case where I think you can't tell in advance where understanding is going to come from. As a matter of fact, I think a lot of understanding does come from scientific studies of infant development, which I think are very useful, though I think some other scientific studies are quite misleading. But I think also you have to look and see with an open mind whether some great religious thinkers are also going to throw light on that, with a completely open mind. And I'm not talking about the Christian religion only. Some of them I find completely disbelievable. But on that particular question, I've learned some things from science and some things from religious thinkers. So the idea that one or the other is going to answer every type of question seems to me quite unbelievable. And I think we've got the rather difficult job that for each question we take, we've got with an open mind to wonder where understanding is going to come from. And it'll sometimes be from one, sometimes from the other, sometimes from both, sometimes from neither.
Does anybody want to respond to that?
Oh, I don't like compromises of that kind. I don't think that religion can provide an explanation of anything. It is the psychology of the person that is providing the explanation. You have to look into someone's behavior, their upbringing, their conditioning. You have to look at, I don't see that just belief in God is an explanation. Science also, if I can just develop that further, to think about how the war in Iraq is going to evolve. Science is not into the business of prediction of that kind, and it should not be expected to be, but it should certainly be expected to understand in due course the roots of the conflict and the reasons why people went to war, their motives, their psychological motives. I keep coming back to that term, because so much of the things that are being discussed now in this kind of intervention concerns a person's reaction to events.
Now, we're coming very close to the end of our time, and there's still a lot of people want to speak, so I think perhaps we should take two last questions, although there are lots of hands up. But George Zoros, would you like to... You've been waiting for a long time.
Yeah, this is a question for Keith Ward, actually. I think you brushed away the question... I mean, you said that we should take the best from religion, but I think this is kind of a little bit... You know, you're not really facing the problem. We're talking about conflict or peaceful coexistence. It seems that religions themselves cannot coexist with each other. So how could it actually coexist with science in general? And then there's so many problems, like, I mean, Iraq is one. Or we can go back to, I don't know, the Crusades. We can go back to the Holocaust. I mean, those are real problems. We cannot just say, well, we have to take the best from religion for that.
I was suggesting that you should take the best, and that religion should change. If you had religious beliefs, if you believed in God, you should be prepared to modify that belief in accordance with both new moral perceptions and new insights from the sciences. There is no scientific evidence for anything that I wish to deny. I would want to accept it. The only question is it going to contradict religion? My answer to that was, well, it contradicts some religious views, and you should change those views that it contradicts. Does this leave religion? Well, it leaves the central forms of religion, which are in the Semitic tradition. You can certainly be a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim and have no conflict with science at all, as long as you take what Peter calls, Peter on my left, calls a non-literal view. I prefer to call it, well, it doesn't matter what I prefer to call it. So it's a question whether you don't get a general answer, but there are certainly forms of belief in a God, and strong belief in a God, which will shape your whole life, which would welcome anything that science can do to help explanation.
Now, we're really coming to the end of our time, but I'm going to take two short questions. There's a girl right at the back with her hand up.
Thank you. My name is Roland. I'm also a student here at LSE. I think I'd like to pose this question also to Professor Peter Atkins. I'd like to push the title of the question a little bit one step further and ask you to comment upon it. Is that, and I'm also speaking from a monotheistic Vedic standpoint. Both the religionist and the scientist present here are basing their arguments and evidence claims conducted within the limits of human capability. However, I contend that the true religion is indeed a science, that religion is not an armchair philosophy subject to mental speculation or a belief system based on mere sentiment. It is actually based on a descending process of knowledge. Evidence for the nature of reality based on science on the ascending process of knowledge, we're using the wrong instrument to gain knowledge of the absolute reality. It's akin to taking the temperature of this room by giving an MP3 player. This analogy serves the purpose to show that religion is indeed a science, that scriptural authority offers a practical theory. Practical application of this theory of the scripture offers the experiment, and then religion provides a conclusion that is the direct perception of true self-realization. I was hoping you could comment upon that.
Well, it's just utter nonsense, isn't it?
I think we'll just take that as a comment, and we'll move to the last question by the pillar.
Yes, I'd like to go back to Peter Atkins' introduction. You stated that science would give us a full understanding of the universe, but yet the universe is pointless. Well, I would suggest a hidden assumption in what you're saying is that if there is a purpose to the universe, it's to be understood. And to me, that suggests that it reflects a faith in the powers of science that is very prevalent nowadays. And I think this faith in science, what it does is it tends to privilege what can be quantified, what is mathematical, what can be expressed in these terms, and to denigrate what is qualitative and which doesn't fit into scientific templates. And at the end of your speech, you came. I found very instructive that you practically call for the extermination, or at least the quarantining of the religious or irrational, or whichever way you want to call it.
Was that the end of the question? Yeah.
Just a response.
I think the quantitative is an approach to science and understanding of extraordinary potency, because you can't argue with mathematics. You can't, if we go back to a point that was made earlier on, perhaps it was Peter on my left, that difficulties come in the interpretation of science when they're expressed in words. I think mathematics is that pure language which is devoid of the emotion that is attached to interpretation and to words. It's a wonderful language for deducing phenomena from theories and for extending theories. And I think that any kind of scientific explanation, when expressed in mathematical terms, takes on its purest form. We shouldn't be afraid of that. Yeah, but now you're reaching into the sort of distant reaches of Gödel's theorem and so on. But you know, there comes a point where you have to say, okay, let's use mathematics. It's a wonderful gift that some people have said is a gift that we don't deserve. I have no idea what that means. But it is an extraordinary language, and we know that it might fray at the edges when pushed too far. But we have seen no signs of its fraying in the applications that we have used it for so far.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Peter. So we're going to bring the debate to an end now, but let me just summarise in one sentence my own view. I've been sitting on the fence here. I think I'm going to refer to what Peter Lipton's already talked about, reflective equilibrium, a term introduced by Goodman and Rawls in philosophy. And there the idea is that when we balance all the considerations concerning the human condition, both the objective and the subjective aspects from the point of view of facts and of values, we could do this until we reach a stable position that we're comfortable with. But that final equilibrium is something that each of us, in the last analysis, has to decide for themselves. Thank you very much indeed.